Perhaps there will be some changes in the cast. Some think there will, some think there won't. But today, the nation is getting ready for the big drama we witness every 4 years, the political conventions, the campaigns. And the issues are many. Now transcribed on yesterday, today, and tomorrow, they will be analyzed by 8 men whose views are respected. 4 are among the nation's most prominent newspaper editors. 4 are NBC news commentators in Washington. You will hear Roy Roberts, president of the Kansas City Star, Jonathan Daniels, editor of the Raleigh, North Carolina News and Observer, William T. Evew, editor of the Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times, Paul Smith, editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and NBC commentators Morgan Beatty, Richard Harkness, Earl Godwin, and Leif Eade. Who will be the candidates? No one knows definitely. Every man and woman in the country has his or her own idea. In the shuffle, we hear the names of Taft, Warren, General MacArthur on the Republican side, Mr. Truman, Chief Justice Vinson, Paul Douglas on the Democratic side, and the name of General Eisenhower on both sides. Along this line, the opinion of Roy Roberts, president of the Kansas City Star, has always been valued. Listen to what Mr. Roberts thinks, both about the candidates and some of the issues.
I am not a prophet or the son of a prophet. I've been wrong many times in the past, but I will again stick my neck out on one thing. If Ike Eisenhower is nominated for the presidency on either ticket next year, he'll be the next occupant of the White House. Personally, I think if Ike runs, he'll do so as a Republican. Mr. Truman has indicated, gently but subtly, that the Democrats have other plans than Eisenhower. I'm sure Ike's a Republican at heart, although he believes intensely that foreign policy should be entirely nonpartisan or bipartisan. Events in Europe will determine whether he will run, in my judgment. I don't speak for him. But if rearming and rewelding of Western Europe together in a confident compact, and this must include the Germans as well, is well along its way, it's my guess and hunch that Ike would accept an honest-to-goodness draft for the presidency, not because he wants it, but on the grounds of duty. It would assure a measure of continuity in the international policy, and that is uppermost in his thinking. On the other hand, I know he's not in sympathy with the growing bureaucracy in government, the wild spending and regimentation through controls that is slowly but surely suffocating and stifling the free enterprise system of America, which has made this nation great. Is Ike a Republican? Of course he is. He's told me so, that he was a good Kansas Republican like all his forebears. He's one of the most honorable men I've ever known. He simply won't play politics or listen to politics while he's doing his great job in Europe. And about 50% of the progress there represents confidence in General Eisenhower more than anything else. When and if that job is done, that's one story. If it isn't, that's another. Taft right now looks like the alternative. But as Truman gets stronger, Taft might get weaker because the Republicans want a sure winner. The nation needs unity more than it needs Truman or Taft. Ike could bring it. If Ike doesn't run, look for a slugging match between Taft and either Truman or Fred Vinson, the Chief Justice. I don't pretend again to speak for the president, nor be in his confidence. Everyone thinks he's a cinch to run. I'll stick my neck out again. I don't. If he feels certain his foreign policy will be carried forward without an abrupt break, and that would come by the nomination of Eisenhower by the Republicans, I think he'd step aside. He may anyway, and let Vinson fight it out, even though it's no secret Truman has always had a hankering to run against Taft. As for the MacArthur episode and the part Atchison, the controversy over Atchison will play in the campaign, events in the Far East will determine that, just as events in Europe this fall and winter will determine the future of Eisenhower. If the truce breaks down in Korea, it's quite evident the administration will have to adopt most of the MacArthur policy. It's done a lot of it already. There is no other alternative. If a firm truce is had, again, that's another story.
The name of Jonathan Daniels has long been outstanding in Democratic ranks. The Raleigh, North Carolina editor is a close friend of President Truman. He's in a position to analyze just what, if any, part the Dixiecrats will play in the coming elections. Mr. Daniels has made known his views in an article appearing in the current issue of American Magazine. And now his voice as he presents his views on the Southern political situation.
It seems to me that with every month that passes, there's less and less chance of a recurrence in 1952 of the so-called Dixiecrat revolt of 1948. I think this is so not because those people who revolted before have come to any new affection for Truman or the Truman type of Democrat, but because there is a realization that the South, to be effective, must fight within the Democratic Party. The Dixiecrats didn't do anything for the South before, but lose strength for it in the contests in this nation. Because of the Dixiecrat revolt, under the regular rules of apportionment, the South is going to have fewer votes at the convention next year than it had 4 years ago. But the Dixiecrat revolt didn't pay off even for those who led it. Their prestige has sunk to a new low. Strom Thurmond in South Carolina was himself, though the presidential candidate of the so-called Dixiecrats, unable to secure the nomination for the United States Senate from South Carolina. A man with the prestige of Jimmy Burns might do something if he would lead such a revolt, but Jimmy Burns has made it pretty clear that he's leading no such revolt, and the people who are willing to lead it will not find the South willing to follow them. The most important thing, however, seems to me to be that we have changed both the mood and the issues in America in the last 3 years, and that they move to a point where they will be more sharply drawn next year. The South, with the rest of the country, certainly the Democrats all over the country, realize that Truman today is fighting not merely for the civil rights of some Americans, but for the liberties and the security of all Americans. We haven't forgotten domestic questions, but we move to very important and very high foreign policy. In that fight, the South has always been behind such a program as Truman pursues today, a plan for an effective peace in the face of an implacable enemy. And the sort of foreign policy that Truman leads is the sort of foreign policies which, since Woodrow Wilson, the South has strongly supported. Next year, the big issue will be the issue of foreign policy. I believe Harry Truman will be the candidate leading that issue, and I am sure that in that fight, the South will take its regular, its historic, its proper place in the Democratic Party in the elections of 1952. I see no Dixiecrat revolt. I think we shall see the solid South in the solid Democratic Party again.
On this same subject, NBC commentator Leif Eade has been canvassing the Washington scene. Here are his findings.
From where I sit, pondering that broad wonderland of politics they call Dixie, only three things look certain in 1952. One, the South is and will remain considerably less than mild about Harry S. Truman. Two, Southern delegates to the Democratic Convention in Chicago in July next year will protest and use their votes to protest a Truman renomination if President Truman decides to run again. Three, the South will put up no Dixiecrat candidate for president as it did in 1948. Well, there is one other thing you can say for sure, and that is that Republican Senator Muntz's idea of an amalgamation of Southern Democrats with Northern Republicans to form one party will get nowhere at all. Practical men just don't ignore political traditions. Southern Democrats will vote for nobody tagged with a Republican label. They're Democrats. But once you've said these things, you've got to go iffy. The Southern Democrats' quarrel with President Truman is not on foreign policy, which is likely to be the big issue in 1952. They're with the president on that one right down the line. Their quarrel with the president is over social legislation, things like FEPC and bills to kill Taft-Hartley. They'll tell you that they're not anti-labor or anti-Negro and point to a considerable amount of progressive legislation in southern states and liberal men in office to prove their point. Although that word liberal is in pretty bad repute these days in the South. But they want to do these things their own way, and they object and object hard to any blanket national laws rammed down Southern throats. What are they going to do about it?
That's where the frustration sets in. The Southern Convention delegates will go to Chicago, but they won't vote for Harry Truman. They might put their votes of protest behind a man like Senator Dick Russell of Georgia, as they did in 1948. There might even be some walkouts at the convention if they're asked to make it unanimous for Harry S. Truman, although some of the cooler heads realize that's a pretty futile gesture, just as futile as the Dixiecrat ticket in 1948. What do they do then? Well, on election day, they could stay home in large numbers, but probably there would still be enough Democratic votes to carry the South for the traditional party. The Southern Democrats' best hope, from what I've been able to find out, is that President Truman has decided not to run again himself, but is tightening control over the party machine so that he would be able to pick his successor. In that case, with Northern Democrats perhaps split among themselves, the Southern Democrats feel that they would have enough power at the convention to block any candidate handpicked by President Truman and to get a man satisfactory to the South on a platform that the South would accept. Met my friend with a long white beard today at the bus stop as usual, and he said, "No what?" And I said, "No what?" And he said, "Well, kiddo, if you really want a good tip on the line the Dixie Boys will take, keep a sharp eye on that Southern Governors Conference at Hot Springs, Arkansas, early this November."
One voice which has left its impact on the American scene is that of the Wisconsin Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy. What sort of criticism does he face? What do his opponents think about his chances in the coming Wisconsin elections? How do they feel about his influence on the campaigns? We now have a sample from one of his outstanding critics, William T. Evew, editor of the Capital Times of Madison, Wisconsin.
A comparison of present discernible trends with what was happening a year ago gives the best clue of what the impact of McCarthyism will be on the 1952 campaign. The most significant thing about Senator McCarthy's campaign today is that he is being maneuvered from an offensive to a defensive position. A year ago, when I was in Washington, the McCarthy offensive had reached its peak. It appeared to me that he had chased everybody into the cyclone cellar. There are now signs that the wave of his offensive has been broken against the good sense of the American people. The President of the United States has taken the lead in striking back at the fear and distrust McCarthy's campaign has engendered. Members of the Senate are accepting the challenge of the methods he has used. The Monroney Committee has unanimously condemned his part in the Maryland campaign against Senator Tiding. Senator Benton of Connecticut has asked the Senate to give consideration to an expulsion resolution. The nation has waited for more than a year for Senator McCarthy to prove his charges. 567 days have elapsed since he first made his charges at Wheeling, West Virginia, that he held in his hand the names of 205 card-carrying communists in the State Department who were known to Secretary Acheson. In those 567 days, Senator McCarthy has failed to produce proof against a single person. In his desperation to keep the offensive, he has made even more reckless and irresponsible charges, including the charge that General Marshall is part of a conspiracy to sell this nation out to the communists. There are unmistakable signs in Wisconsin that McCarthyism is running its course. He has been condemned by several young Republican organizations in this state, groups from which he once commanded strong support. Secretary of State Zimmerman, one of the wisest and most potent vote-getters in Republican ranks in Wisconsin, has come out publicly against him. There are other signs that McCarthyism has run its course here in Wisconsin.
And now, Senator McCarthy answers Editor Evew.
In my opinion, the one all-important overriding issue to be decided by the people in 1952 is whether they want to continue with the present disastrous, suicidal foreign policy, a policy under which the free half of the world has been losing 100 million people every year to the communist half of the world since the war ended. Now, from this bankrupt foreign policy flows practically every other woe which besets the nation, such as inflation, high taxes,
and the absence from home of so many young men in the service. Now, the best that can be said about those who have been in complete charge of our foreign policy, is that we are losing 100 million of people a year because our planners are incompetent. The other alternative is that they planned it that way. Now, normally, it could be expected that our course would have changed after exposed traitors and communist agents, such as Wadley, Hiss, and Marzani, were removed from the State Department. But the course did not change one iota. This can mean but one thing to any person of average intelligence. Now, I note that one of the speakers on the program is Mr. William Evu of Madison. So that his statements can be better evaluated, let me point out that I have in my hand an editorial written on March 14, 1941, in which Evu states about one of his reporters, and I quote, he says, "Mr. Cedric Parker is the communist leader in Madison." Now, since that time, Evu promoted Parker so that as of this moment, Parker is Evu's city editor and undoubtedly wrote the speech which Evu gave on the air. Let me repeat again. Evu says, "Parker is the communist leader in Madison." And to throw further light on Evu's activities, on May 4, 1950, the National Secretary of the Communist Party issued the following proclamation. I quote, "I urge all Communist Party members to yield second place to none in the fight to rid the country of the fascist poison of McCarthyism." Evu's paper promptly followed the Daily Worker, even using the same adjectives and smear phrases coined by the Daily Worker. They've gone right straight down the line.
But how about the Washington Outlook? For this, we've asked one of our seasoned Capitol observers to discuss McCarthyism. Here is NBC commentator Morgan Beatty.
The role of Senator Joe McCarthy in the nation at large is far different than it is in Wisconsin. There are three important elements in McCarthyism on a national scale, and we report these elements without regard to the merit or demerit in his case. First, the Republican point of view. The senator from Wisconsin represents, to many Republicans, hope for revival after 20 lean years. To some, he is the John Brown of an earlier day. He serves his cause with flaming words and action, like a Sir Galahad. Slavery was the cry in Civil War days, communism the cry today. To the, shall we say, practical wing of the Republican Party, McCarthy represents the two-fisted, pugnacious kind of a fighter the party must have to win in 1952. Many of these practical men do not agree with the senator. They themselves would not use the smear tactics he frankly admitted he used against Democratic Senator Tidings of Maryland. But as McCarthy himself has bragged, Senator Tidings is no longer in the United States Senate. Neither is his arch critic, former Senator and Majority Leader Scott Lucas of Illinois. Senator McCarthy claims his kind of rough and ready politics eliminated these two men, and the party needs more of the same. Those who won't fight that way, he says, are but puny, pale imitations, and they'll be steamrollered, and they deserve it. There's a third strong, persistent element in the Republican Party, of course, that not only does not approve of McCarthyism, but is actively fighting to block him off the first team in 1952. They think his tactics will alienate more voters than they win. And he will be vulnerable, they say, to exactly the same smear that he himself has practiced. Element number two in McCarthyism. There's still another political point of view. The fact is, whether the Democrats like it or not, Joe McCarthy is working the same political strategy on the Democrats that they pulled on the Republicans to expose Teapot Dome. In 1924, the Democrats didn't have the proof of scandal when they started. They didn't think they would get it, but they fired away, they smeared, they wrestled, they charged, until finally the proof began to well up from the mass of facts, namely that the Republicans of the 20s had engineered a big steal, and too many of their number had pocketed a part of the spoils or had winked at crime. Two leading citizens went to jail in 1929, and that fact confirmed the voters in their suspicions. The Republicans were beaten in 32. So in conclusion, objectively, from a national point of view, point three, the element in McCarthyism, McCarthy's methods may well be deplored. Our best citizens may take steps to bar such tactics in our politics. But these tactics have been used before by John Brown, among others. They have been successful regardless of their merit, and that fact alone leads many canny Democratic leaders to this conclusion. As far as the Democrats are concerned, Joe McCarthy is the most dangerous man on the American political horizon in 1952. Far more dangerous than the presidential candidate the party will name. If you don't believe it, take note. President Truman himself has led the attack on Joe McCarthy from the very start, and he'll keep on attacking from now on until Election Day.
During the past year, we've heard stories of Washington influence, stories of deep freezers, mink coats, free hotel rooms. They brought with them the question of morals and ethics in government, to say nothing of reverberations from all parts of the country. Where does the fault lie? Is it strictly in the hands of government officials, or does each of us share the blame? Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow has obtained comment on this issue from a point far removed from Washington. We went to San Francisco and there contacted Paul Smith, editor of the San Francisco Chronicle. Mr. Smith told us this.
There is no doubt in my mind that morality and ethics in government will be one of the major issues of the forthcoming national election campaign. We have been treated to some shocking scandals over the past few years. However, objectivity and intellectual integrity require that not even strongly anti-administration elements have the right to lay the blame exclusively at the door of the administration. Lax attitudes, disregard of the old and tested principles of integrity, the bad manners of cynicism are rather widespread failings today. Deep freezes, mink coats, commodity speculations, free hotel rooms, and the scores of special favors granted to those in administration circles who have the power to favor one citizen to the detriment of another are the sensations. But it is because of our general public attitude that the spoilsmen and the hoodlums grow fat and overconfident. The American voter soon will enter an area of deep responsibility to which he must be alive and alert. Morality in government is an issue, and a proper one. But as the campaign develops, the American must realize that there are political elements that are not above immorally and unethically capitalizing on the very issue of morals and ethics. I fear it will grow more and more difficult for the American voter to preserve intact his fundamental adherence to the principles of due process, including the basic American tenet of presumption of innocence until guilt is proved. It is simple to smear unjustly, and the American voter must be ever on guard against smear techniques and the propaganda of rumor, insinuation, and inference. These immoral forms of attack are a dangerous part of the intellectual corruption which rides high today. I'm convinced that morals and ethics, just common honesty and decency, and incidentally intellectual honesty as well as money honesty, are big issues in the forthcoming campaign, and properly so. How they will affect the outcome, no man can say. But it must be remembered that the real test is our net capacity to live by the principles of honor and integrity required for the safety of a government resting, in the last analysis, on democratic decision. Therefore, our people must energetically examine their own individual and collective intellectual honesty and their own sense of responsibility and public trust. The days ahead cry out for high purpose and incorruptible devotion to the cause of freedom. When there is weakness in the moral fabric of government, repairs must be made. And these repairs are essential if this form of government is to survive. There is no room for demagogy within the limits of this problem. Demagogy itself is immoral. There is no room for bleak cynicism, but there is room for a genuine, honest public indignation. The old-fashioned but eternally valid principles of true honor and integrity is a vital issue of the November 1952 election. But sound reorientation to those principles must be a widespread public enterprise, or the issue will not be adequately resolved in 1952. After 1952, may be too late.
There's a saying among newsmen that if you have a story involving a man's pocketbook, you have a good story. The saying seems now to hold true in the coming elections. At least NBC's Earl Godwin is convinced that the high cost of living and taxation will be big issues.
Although the issues in any presidential campaign can easily depend on the candidates, it seems that a natural issue will be high prices and heavy taxes. This, of course, from the opposition. Already there's building up a pressure like an overworked boiler against the infiltration of the tax collector into everything needed in the plain living of every American from the cradle to the grave. From the time an American citizen rolls out of bed and makes himself a cup of pre-breakfast coffee, through the day which may start with an automobile trip on heavily taxed roads with super-taxed gasoline, to the time he puts out the light for which he will get taxed utility bills, America is saturated with taxation. and it'll take only a mild recession of industry and national income to make that a burning issue. But this issue will be without effect if the money continues to roll out and the dollars are not too much inflated and devalued. Already, President Truman has begun to boast about that situation, which in the high bicycle days was called the full dinner pail. Sure, you're taxed, but also you have loads more money and everybody's getting it. That is, enough of everybody is getting it to make the issue of high prices and high taxes red hot and debatable. These days, every time President Truman utters a word, he's likely to be making an issue or a plank for his own platform should he run again. That would make Truman the issue. His warm personal interest in the flood sufferers in the mid-continent river valleys make no issue, but makes a platform all by itself. If Truman is not the Democratic candidate, his party will make the general leadership of America in world peace one big issue, and unless someone kicks over the industrial apple cart, Democrats will chortle over prosperity. Republicans will have for an issue also what the candidate of their choice emits as his own ideas.
What does the Capitol itself think about these issues? One individual in a position to know is NBC's political analyst, Richard Harkness.
One point has struck you, I'm sure. As you've heard these four distinguished editors report on the issues as they see them in the 1952 campaign. Now, that point is that these issues have been discussed this afternoon as developments in the future. As, all of a sudden, as if the politicians and the voters would awake from a long winter's sleep and say, here are the pros and cons of the presidential congressional elections. You realize, covering Washington here, that the 1952 campaign is on now. I'll take McCarthyism. President Truman has set out deliberately to take the offensive now against Senator McCarthy. Or let's take high prices and taxes. Now, the Senate will take up shortly the new $6 billion defense tax bill. Well, the president asked Congress for almost $5 billion more. But, quoting Senator Walter George, the Democrat of Georgia, Mr. Truman simply doesn't have the capacity to say no to the military. And Senator George goes on. He says, every time the Pentagon asks the White House for more money, Congress cannot load a new tax bill on the people. Now, that is a campaign issue now. Coming from George of Georgia, it ties in with Jonathan Daniels' reaction from the South. You know, there's that old tried-and-true saying in politics that people vote their pocketbooks. So we see now that Democrats and Republicans alike are scrambling to get the microphone these days and blame those high prices on the other fellow. Now, one wonders if we've forgotten so soon the nauseating revelations of the Senate Crime Investigating Committee. Now, this issue is double-edged, a link-up between hoodlums and Democratic politicians in New York and Chicago, and political thievery laid on Republican doorsteps in Philadelphia and in New Jersey. Now, these may be local issues, but in 1952, on the revulsion or on the complacency of the American voter, may hinge those key pivotal states, New York, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Illinois. Oh, we think of campaigns, for instance, not so much in terms of issues, but rather in terms of personalities. We've heard today in this newscast, this report, no new names. Almost general agreement that President Truman will run again, with Mr. Chief Justice Vincent a possibility, and in Republican ranks, Taft and Eisenhower. But the issues of the 1952 campaign are being made here and now.
There you have it. The issues, the likely candidates in the forthcoming elections, a preview of what all of us can look to in the 14 months remaining before we elect a president of the United States and a Congress to lead us. Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow has given you this transcribed preview. Script has been by Arthur Barrio, your narrator, Morris McGarry. This has been a presentation of the NBC News and Special Events Department. In Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, NBC brings you a complete discussion of the momentous events occurring in the world today. It takes you behind the scenes to hear these events discussed by world leaders who are making the news and by men whose lives are devoted to keeping you informed. Listen again next Sunday when Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow will present a complete study of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.